Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you in the air by listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign at 90.1 FM in central Illinois, and webcasting live worldwide at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed here, those speakers do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Bob with some of our underwriting announcements.
The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour on WEFT. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to effect excellence and equity in public education and to be the advocacy organization for all public education employees. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And this hour programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, give them a call at 217-328-2295.
Okay, thank you, Bob. We're going to be having, we have a special guest in the studio here live, Jim Eyman, who's co-host of Labor's Worldview TV, musician extraordinaire, labor historian, and activist. So, we'll have him in the show here real soon. And at half past the hour, John Ryman, a retired carpenter and author from Oakland, California, will be calling. And we're going to be talking about what's been happening with our unions over the last 50, 60 years. In other words, how are things different now than they were, say, back right after the end of the Second World War in the 1950s? And, you know, maybe even before the 1930s and stuff. Also, we have a special guest, once known as Bob, is sitting in here, observing, and, he might have a comment or two as well, and feel free to do that, Bob. And, I guess we'll go to, Bob Plesney, for some, news stories.
All right, the Associated Press reported earlier this week, and so you probably heard, the Seattle City Council unanimously passed an ordinance Monday that gradually increases the minimum wage in the city to $15 per hour, which would make it the highest in the nation. It says here, the issue has dominated politics in the liberal municipality for months, and a boisterous crowd of mostly labor activists packed the council chambers for the vote. Mayor Ed Murray, who was elected last year, had promised in his campaign to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. A newly elected socialist city council member had pushed the idea as well. "We did it. Workers did this," said Kashama Savant, the socialist city council member. "We need to continue to build an even more powerful movement." Council member Tom Rasmussen said Seattle wants to stop the race to the bottom in wages and address the widening gap between the rich and the poor. The measure takes effect April 1st of 2015, includes a phase-in of the wage increase over several years with a slower process for small businesses. The plan gives businesses with more than 500 employees nationally at least 3 years to phase in the increase. Those providing health insurance will have 4 years to complete the move. Smaller organizations will be given 7 years. So, needless to say, some organizations, the International Franchise Association, came out against the move, what did they say? "The city council's action today is unfair, discriminatory, and a deliberate attempt to achieve a political agenda at the expense of the small franchise business owners."
500 employees or less is a small business. Give me a break. It should be five employees or less. Yeah. I mean, that's...
Yeah, it's amazing how flexible the definition of small business can be.
Indeed.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like there's some governments that it's $1 million in revenue or something a year. Another one's number of employees, which can vary great widely.
I think I heard a couple of years ago that Coke Industries was classified in some respects as a small business.
Which, please.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, what else you have, Bob?
I got this story that actually Aaron Ammons mentioned it this morning on Higher Ground, and I hadn't heard about it happening until he said something this morning. But it actually says here the headline, Supervisor Threatens to Hang Worker from Drinking from the White People Fountain.
And this is something that happened just recently?
This week. Actually, it was happening, I guess, last November, December through January. Mm-hmm. And the two workers at a place, Atkinson Cotton Warehouse in Memphis, Tennessee, filed a discrimination act against this unfair employment against this company.
I hope so.
But it says here, the recording sounds like something from Jim Crow days, a white supervisor threatening to hang an African-American employee for drinking water from a white people fountain. It says, but it's 2014 in Memphis, Tennessee. Antonio Harris, who worked at the Atkinson Cotton Warehouse, said he used his phone to record his supervisor after feeling discriminated against for months. You know, in the audio, Harris asked if he can use a microwave, and the ex-worker supervisor said he'd hang me. You know, he says, hell no, a man who describes as a supervisor responds. So anyway, we got this report from WREG, a TV station down there in Memphis, Tennessee, so we might as well just play that and listen to the workers' recording of a supervisor. It's really incredible that this stuff goes on in this day and age.
Indeed. Okay, here we go.
New at 5, shocking allegations of racial discrimination in a Memphis cotton gin. Two men filed charges against the Atkinson Cotton Warehouse. They're accusing their former supervisor of calling them monkeys and saying the water fountain and microwave are for white people only. WREG's Sabrina Hall is live with the former employees who say they have proof of the abuse. Sabrina.
Yeah, one of the employees says he was so sick of the abuse, he decided to record some of it one day so people would actually believe that this was going on.
The cotton industry's history reminds some of slavery. Antonio Harris.
I was a forklift operator.
And Mario Mangrum.
He'll be like, you need to think like a white man.
Say their former supervisor at Atkinson Cotton Warehouse was stuck in the past.
He done pulled his clothes down in front of him, kiss his white tail.
And Antonio says after months of racist comments and feeling powerless.
Hey, black boy, get over there and get my cotton.
He decided to use his phone as a weapon to fight back. He recorded his attempt to drink water from a fountain in the warehouse office.
Hey, I need to put a sign here that says white people only.
He recorded his attempt to use the microwave.
I didn't use the microwave.
No, hell no.
Why can't you use
the
microwave, man?
No, you're not white.
For real? That's a white man.
We don't need that Larry look
you. Larry been there 10, 20 years, and he's a black guy also.
In the recording, the supervisor also talks about the days where blacks and whites were kept separate.
But back then, nobody thought anything about it. Now, you know, it's everybody is made.
About 30 seconds later in the recording, listen to this.
Put your sand on the water then, because I'm finna drink it. What they do when they catch me drinking your water?
Well, that's what we hate.
I think about this every day. Every day of my life.
Antonio and Mario filed a discrimination charge with the EEOC, which is now mediating with the cotton gin's owner about a possible settlement. Antonio says it's not about the cotton industry.
I worked for a cotton company for 12 years, and they never did nothing like that to me.
He says it's about a man.
He isn't one just an employee. He was the supervisor, the head supervisor.
Who left lasting and painful memories with two workers just trying to support their families.
Now, the owner of the cotton gin says he has no comment, but he does say the management at that warehouse is provided by another company. We tried to contact that outsourcing company. They did not call us back, but we did talk to an employee today that works at the warehouse, and he says that supervisor still works there, but is on vacation today. Reporting live, Sabrina Hall, WREG News Channel 3.
Okay, yeah. Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, Dave, so the owner of the cotton processing plant down there, E.W. Atkinson, says that he outsources the running of that to another company called Federal Compress, and according to them, they say they have a zero tolerance policy on discrimination, but, and according to this story, it says the supervisor was fired after an investigation, but according to that TV reporter, she says that he was on vacation, so, kinda interesting, but E.W. Atkinson claims that, he didn't know anything about it and that he outsources the operations of his own cotton gin to, another company and he's blaming it on them, so. Anyway, interesting that that could go on in this day and age.
It's, pretty, unbelievable, frankly. But anyway, okay, we're gonna, now, turn to some music and then, we'll be, right back.
Gotta pull this timber before the sun go down. Get it across the river before the falls come round. Drag it on down that dusty road. Come on, Jerry, let's dump this load.
Hauling
timber, timber. Lord, this timber got a roll.
Timber,
timber, timber. Lord, this timber got a roll. My old Jerry is an Arkansas mule. Been everywhere and he ain't no fool. Work it heavy, old Jerry gets sore. Pull so much and won't pull no more.
Hauling
timber, timber. Lord, this timber got a roll.
Timber,
timber, timber. Lord, this timber got a roll. Jerry's old shoulder is 6 foot tall. Pull more timber than a freight can haul. Weigh 922. Done everything a poor mule could do.
Hauling
timber, timber. Lord, this timber got a roll.
Timber,
timber, timber. Lord, this timber got a roll. Jerry and he made him jump. Jerry ran and kicked the boss on the rump. My old Jerry was a good old mule. Had it been me, Lord, I'd have killed that fool. Boss tried to shoot old Jerry in the head. Jerry ducked that bullet and he stomped him dead. Stomped that boss till I wanted to scream. Should I killed him cause he's so damn mean.
Hollin.
Okay, that was a song by Josh White, who Jim Iman here can maybe talk a little about. This is from a compilation called The Leftist Roots of the Folk Revival, and this was a song called Jerry about a some kind of timber work gang, and the only one willing to stand up to the boss and fight back was the work mule, Jerry. So I like that song, you know, as far as
it's a good one.
Yeah. But tell us a little about that compilation a little bit, since you are, you know, a musician.
All right. Well, actually, this compilation was given to me when I was in the hospital years ago by Paul Mute.
Oh, okay.
And, it's pretty scarce to try to find. And if you can find it, you're going to pay big buckos for it. So we're lucky we have it. I think you've got everything that's on there recorded. Josh White was an interesting black guy. He was a professional bluesman in New York, worked the Village a lot and other places, Harlem. And he was also an activist in the struggle for black folks' rights, for civil rights for black people in this country. Other than that, I don't know a great deal about him, but he's certainly a fine bluesman.
Yes, indeed. Okay, I wanted to just read a couple of public service announcements here real quick, and then we're going to get into kind of the heart of our topic today. Then another sports show, Left Sports Radio, with host fellow worker Neil Parthen. It plays today on WRFU 104.5 from 2 to 3 p.m., and you can also check it out on Comcast Channel 6, your band of public television, on Wednesdays from 6 to 7. 7. Also tomorrow, Sunday, and every Sunday is from 4 to 5 p.m. is Labor's Worldview TV. And also, I want to basically offer a special invitation to anybody out there for basically this is every first Saturday of the month. The local anti-war group AWARE has a monthly demonstration on the corner of Main and Neal Street in downtown Champaign. And this is toward just to remind people out there that there are still not just a war, but multiple wars and conflicts going on that our government is conducting in our name with our tax money, and that the AWARE organization has this monthly demonstration so people don't forget what's going on in their name and with their money, and to also just you know, embolden people, because all the polls conducted in the last several years show that you know, 60-some percent, I mean, it varies, it's in the 60 percentile range of the American people want an end to all these wars and all the troops brought home. So if you can turn out for that, that demonstration is at 2 p.m. at the corner of Neal and Main Street, downtown Champaign. And before then, we're having a luncheon at the Esquire Lounge, so feel free to come on down for some you know, good food at the Esquire, and also for some good conversation with some good people before the demonstration. So anyway, okay, sort of the topic we've got going today here
Hey,
is...
Dave.
Yes.
I want to mention some, you were mentioning WEFT radio shows and stuff. I want to mention a couple that I really like that you can download.
Oh, okay.
Actually from radioforall.net. And by the way, send radioforall.net money. One is called Unwelcome Guests.
I like the title of that.
It's a, yes, it is a, Woody Guthrie song. And, that was, done by Billy Bragg and Wilco on that Mermaid Avenue album several years ago. But it's been a really good show that's been on for quite some time. It was, started by an American woman whose name I can't recall. I don't have the information in front of me. And it's currently being done by an Englishman who is living in Bangladesh.
Oh, interesting.
And, this turned me on to such things as we've talked about, they spend a lot of time reading from books, which might sound very boring, but it is a very good way to get this information into your head, you know, listening to them. It's like an audio book. They also compile other radio shows, and it's always on topics, and I've learned many very interesting and new things on many topics, especially economics, you know, law, society, and everything else. Another program is Smells Like Human Spirit, which is done by an Englishman named Guy Evans, who currently lives in New York City. Now, I haven't seen it on radioforall.net lately, but these people also talk about being on iTunes and such.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can do a search for them. They have their own websites.
Mm-hmm.
But they are very interesting shows, interesting guests. This Guy Evans guy on Smells Like Human Spirit, when he was still in England, it was like his first guest was Noam Chomsky.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know. He tried going daily for a while instead of weekly. I don't know if he's still doing that. But
okay.
I just wanted to mention those things, that when you're not listening to great public affairs programs on WEFT and you don't feel like listening to music, maybe look at radioforall.net. There are many shows on there. There's some shows done by the Bristol Bolt Broadband Cooperative by Tony Gosling that I find fascinating, even when they're talking about local Bristol issues.
Okay. And radioforall.net, of course, is where the World Labor Hour past programs, or at least a select past programs, are archived.
Yes. And to mention another show, and one of my heroes, Cindy Sheehan.
Oh, yes.
Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox is on there. And she recently lost the primary for governor of California.
Mm-hmm.
But she has great shows. This woman starting out being upset about her son dying in a war has gone on to promulgate a great economic analysis, a very Marxist analysis. It's an amazing how she has progressed over the years in these terms. She's actually a very brilliant woman. She's not just some bereaved mother housewife.
Okay. Well, thanks for that, Bill. Okay.
Okay, Mime. You can take the floor.
Thank you,
for the
Bill.
Mic, I guess.
Yeah, well, we do have a mic. I have to give John Kerry a slap on the back for pointing out that RT is a propaganda channel. Their viewers have enormously gone up. And you have to remember, too, out there, listeners, that WEFT is another propaganda channel and deserves your ear.
It's the truth, though. I mean, truth propaganda. RT television is great. I mean, of course, if anything they talk about dealing with Russia, because RT is for Russian television. Russia Today. Thank you. You might want to take a little, be a little skeptical, but, boy, I'll tell you, especially Abby Martin's program, who's, is an American, and she's not just a journalist, she's an activist too. And I mean, she's said some things that's bucked the editorial policy of RT television, and she still has her job, So, I mean, I'll have to give him credit for that. I mean, like when she was interviewed on BBC America and they asked her about that, she goes, well, the difference between RT television, if I was working for you or another corporate media outlet, is that I would have lost my job.
Oh, yeah. Well, you got to remember other things, too. There's always a great big the objectivity of media and people talking about bias, and we have to have balance. So that means on one side we have 99% of the world's climate scientists, but we have to give equal time to
the 1%
paid off nutcase.
Yeah.
That's in a hireling of the oil industry.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think that is just.
Or when Phil Donahue, before he was forced out of his program, MSNBC, when the Iraq invasion, right before the Iraq invasion, he had one guest on against the invasion, one for it, and he was told by his producers that in the future he had to have three pro-war people on for every one anti-war person.
Wow, and quota system.
He refused to do it. The next program he had equal number, and I guess that's when he lost his program.
Oh, maybe I can find this somewhere. It was somebody who used to be on The Daily Show.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah, John Oliver.
Yes.
Yes, he did a climate change one.
Yes, I saw that.
Like
that
one person in a room that was anti-climate change and brought in like
99 scientists. Yeah, that was good. Okay.
Here's what I want to bring up about that. It was used to be always be said that people in Russia knew they were reading propaganda,
yes,
improv, and hearing it over TASS.
Yes.
Whereas in the United States, this faux pretense of objectivity creates a false sense of security that they are hearing both sides or an accurate news or anything like that. Whereas if you know, for example, if you get to know a film critic, what they think and how they feel, what their tastes are, you might know that if they don't like a film, you'll like it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just it. If you know somebody's bias, you can deal with it.
Yes.
And it is much more honest to reveal that bias than it is to try and hide it.
Indeed. And like you said, supposedly, quote unquote, both sides. There's no such thing. We don't live in a linear world.
Or there might be 12 sides.
Indeed.
You never know. I mean.
But even if it's linear, there's one of our friends, I won't mention his name, is fond of saying it's called the limits of allowable debate. In other words, the parameters are certain, basically from rabid right wing to milk toast moderate. It's basically supposedly right and left in this country.
Yeah. What was conservative? Mikhail Foucault had, discursive formation.
Okay.
It's like some things are outside of our discursive formation and thus they cannot be discussed.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Very good. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on WFT, a listener support community radio station in Champaign, Illinois. So to get into our hard-hour matter, Jim, yes, we invited you to come on the show today basically to talk about the state of our unions. What kind of motivated you to sort of suggest we do a program like this?
Outlook.
Outward.
What is the future of labor going to be? What are the organizing techniques? What has worked? What has not worked? What the obstacles are? In my opinion, we have to start with the fact that all contradictions in the world today, wars, revolutions, counter-revolutions, ethno-phobia, all this is rooted in the struggle of labor against capital. Since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, this has been the case.
And labor is basically anybody who has to work for a living. I mean, or someone retired. Basically, anyone who doesn't make their living off of clipping
owning stock, capital.
Owning capital, yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, where does capital come from except from labor?
Mm-hmm.
You work. There is a certain amount that they keep. It's called surplus value.
You're paid, or known as profit,
You're paid $10 an hour, they make $25. $15 an hour, they have in surplus value. It is and this is known as exploitation. It's not oppression necessarily. The working conditions could be quite nice. They're just taking your product and making money off of it. Now you can say, well, gold is wealth, but it takes labor to get gold out of the ground. Dr. Don Dewey once said that, and the father of modern American education, that manual labor and mental labor should not be distinguished from each other. You cannot think without using your hands, and you cannot use your hands without thinking. That has seemed to have gone down the memory hole in American education.
Yeah, Jim, I'd like to observe that on buildings at the University of Illinois campus that were probably built around the time when Dewey was writing, the motto is learning and labor.
Yes.
And they both go together.
Oh, yeah. Good point, Bill.
Yes, and of course we've gotten away from that. But you know what's interesting in you know, relation to what you just said, Jim, is you know, kind of how labor unions in the United States have basically, what are they doing now? What is their kind of philosophy and mindset, if you will, that basically influences their strategy and actions are now compared to what they were, say, back in the 1950s or even before, in the 1930s or even the late 1800s, you know?
Well, I think the...
Okay, let's see if that's John Ryman. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hi, this is John.
Hi, John. We're talking to John Ryman from Oakland, California, retired union carpenter, labor activist, and author of many booklets, including the one we're going to be talking about on our topic today, his booklet, What Happened to Our Unions. And John, thanks for calling in today. Jim and I were just starting to get into the whole thing of basically how our unions, what they're doing, what their philosophical outlook is today, and how that, of course, affects their actions, compared to what it was, say, in the 1950s, 1930s, or even the late 1800s. And Jim basically started out by saying that everything in the world today, why don't you repeat what you said, Jim?
Every struggle in the world, every contradiction, wars, revolutions, and counter-revolutions are the result of the struggle between capital and labor, and the exploitation of labor by capital. That's the root cause of everything. What's going on with the unions is they seem to have forgotten that. For good reason, the AFL-CIO bureaucracy is basically in the Democratic Party pocket, and we went from liberalism now to neoliberalism. Neoliberalism is the road to neo-fascism. All you have to do is look at the Ukraine.
John, would you disagree with that?
Yeah, I completely agree.
Okay. All right. You know, what's interesting is that I just wanted to kind of take just a minute here and basically read the back of your What Happened to Our Unions, basically sort of a synopsis of this book. But you say here, the unions have it in their power to organize a fight for a decent life for all workers, yet today the union leadership has completely blocked any such drive. As a result, the membership has lost confidence and lost interest in their unions, and this pamphlet tries to explain how the unions got that way and what can be done about it. So why don't we just start from there?
You know what Jim was talking about the inherent conflict between the working class and the owners of capital, corporate America or the business class. And then he was saying the AFL-CIO leadership has completely forgotten about that. And, of course, that goes down from the very tops of the AFL-CIO right down to just about every single local union leader. And what kind of symbolizes that is up in Seattle, where they've had this struggle around the issue of a $15 an hour minimum wage, one of the most powerful union, local union officials there, David Rolfe, was talking about my brothers and sisters in the labor and the business community.
In the labor and business community.
Right, brothers and sisters, right. Yeah.
Sounds like an old, our head of the building trades here in this community for many years before he retired. We used to have a running joke about him that his idea of union solidarity was going to a Chamber of Commerce meeting.
They probably drink at the same pub.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, golf at the same country club.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so where they've had that struggle up there in Seattle around this minimum wage issue, and incidentally, I should say, you know, I mean, it's the objective conditions that have really driven it. I see just in today's paper there was an article that the number of jobs has gone back up to above what it was before 2007, but it's almost all low-wage jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also Seattle's an expensive city to live in.
Right, right. But and this is nationwide.
Okay.
And so you have that, and then you have the Democrats who representing corporate America, but the kind and gentle face of it.
Mm-hmm.
Time that corporate America comes under pressure, then they push the Democratic Party and the Democratic politicians forward in order, maybe they'll have to grant a few concessions, but in order to head off any kind of wider, open, direct conflict and any kind of independent movement of the working class. And then, as Jim was saying, you have the leadership of the unions that is really the representatives of the Democratic Party and the representatives of the employers inside the working class, inside the unions. And
yeah, John, it's nice to talk to you again. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it has.
What I see here is that we almost have to create some kind of a side workers organization, some sort of a national democratic workers syndicate, you know, and where you can belong to that and belong to a, you know, be in a shop with a union. But if there's no union in it, what you want to organize is the alternative union.
Yeah, there you go. A union to represent yourself in your union.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. You know, the IWW is a great idea, and it's come a long way. I never resigned from the IWW, by the way, but
Anyway, John, you know, it's interesting. Jim gave me this old pamphlet from the United Auto Workers from 1959.
Mm-hmm.
And the title of it, Who Gets How Much? And on the back of the pamphlet titled Propaganda, it says, what you're told in the newspapers, over the radio and TV, and in the magazines is a very different story. You're told that big labor is driving prices up by unreasonable demands for wage increases. The truth, of course, is far different. The giant corporations working through near monopoly control rig the key prices in the economy to return exorbitant profits on tractors, steel, farm equipment, gasoline, processed food, automobiles, and so on. In the process, the economy operates far below capacity, and farmers, wage earners, and consumers are prevented from enjoying the well-being and the security the country could provide.
Hey, Dave, I want to bring up an anecdote on that.
Yeah.
It's not really an anecdote. It's just that there's several times, and this happens quite often, this kind of a thing comes up in a conversation on a union construction job,
mm-hmm.
and people will say, well, every time I get a raise, it causes inflation. And I'm like, what? Do you want to give it back to the boss, or you just not want to get a raise, or are you going to turn it down? Oh, no.
Yeah, good point, Bill. I mean, but John, you know, it's interesting.
It shows how propagandized they are.
Right. I mean, in 1959, UAW is basically questioning and informing workers that they should question the whole arrangement of basically the capitalist system. Where in your booklet, you state that I don't know when it started happening, but I'm guessing sometime in the 1970s, where union officials just basically kind of waved the white flag, gave up, and just decided that they basically are going to accept the whole system as is, and that the main objective should be to make money for the corporations and the capitalist class, the bosses.
Truth be told, they've always had that position.
Really?
But in the 50s and the 60s and the early 70s, you had that post-World War II upswing, and for a lot of different reasons, including the existence of the Soviet Union and also the revolutions in the colonial world, the capitalist class here found it more convenient and also necessary to grant concessions to workers. Also, they were raking in the profits hand over fist,
mm-hmm.
so it wasn't that hard for them to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But the union leaders always have that position, even back then. But then when the economic situation turned around and they started going after the working class much more decisively,
mm-hmm.
and they started attacking the unions, then the union leadership, which had always bought into the point of view of corporate America, then they just said, well, you know, you have to make your profits. We accept that. And so if for you to make your profits, our workers are going to have to take a cut. Of course, I as Mr. or Ms. Union official, I'm not going to take a cut.
Mm-hmm.
But I will. We will accept that the workers have to take a cut,
mm-hmm.
and that's what's been going on. And now you see the beginnings of a reaction against that, such as what we've seen up in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. But you know, from what you've posted on your blog at Oakland Socialist, you were talking about, you know, you went up to Seattle twice, wasn't it?
That's right. November,
and
right.
How you noticed how the union leadership was trying to water down and compromise this $15 an hour minimum wage.
I gave the example of that guy David Rolfe,
mm-hmm.
who talked about my and he also said, and he was the chief architect behind the minimum wage ballot initiative at SeaTac Airport, in which they excluded union members from the minimum wage there.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we always want to offer an olive branch to employers of good conscience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is really, he's just one of the most outspoken, most clear representatives of that whole cast up there, and really anywhere else. And so... And One Seattle, which was the employers group dedicated to fighting the minimum wage increase, they had an article in which they said, you know, we might have to have some kind of compromise, and it will allow people like David Rolfe to save face, which we don't want them to save face. We want their face to be really revealed. And it also said, and this is very revealing, it said it will allow us to avoid another WTO moment.
Okay.
And we remember that was the World Trade Organization when the masses of people shut down the city of Seattle in 1999.
Teamsters and turtles.
And so this was possibly a potential that was developing. And I think the position of socialists and really any workers up there or anywhere else should it have to be, you know what, if it takes another WTO moment to get what we want, then so be it, and we are going to set about trying to organize that if it's necessary.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was originally, you know, back shortly after Kashan Sawant was elected to the city council, there was paperwork filed to have a ballot initiative on the November election coming up. Is that still going to happen?
Well, there's one thing there. It wasn't shortly after she was elected.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it was just about a month ago.
Okay.
And that says a lot because, you know, I supported Sawant. I think that her election was an important step forward.
Mm-hmm.
I think it opened up a little more the question of socialism, and it also raised the mood and helped focus attention on this issue of the $15 an hour minimum wage. But when she got elected, she said, I'm going to try to work with the other city council members.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was just, you know, like loose wording. But unfortunately, it seems that that's what she has done and what her group, Socialist Alternative, what they've been doing, rather than focusing on just revealing who they are and revealing the real role of the David Rolfe up there. And so, for instance, you have the grocery workers up there. The courtesy clerks who are working under union contract up there, they make maximum $9.52 an hour. Their union did not support the $15 an hour minimum wage campaign.
Historically, back before the original minimum wage was established, but unions were against minimum wages because they were feared that at some point they would become maximum wages. And here you have this example of how this minimum wage has just blown away what the unions could do for their members and makes the union look superfluous.
Mm-hmm. Right, except that just like David Rolfe, the leadership of the UFCW, just like the leadership of the Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union, all the rest of them, they feel that the success, that is to say, the profitability of their employers, is their success, the success of the union.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What it really means is it's going to, as they see it, make it easier for them to collect a little bit more dues money.
Mm-hmm.
And don't misunderstand me. I was a union worker all my life, and I support unionism completely, but this is something different.
Well, this is like what people used to say about the Soviet Union, actually existing unions, not our idea of what unions should be.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, it would have seemed to me that one thing that they could have done was written up a leaflet saying, aimed at the grocery clerk, saying, brothers and sisters, you are making, many of you are making under $10 an hour. Yet, and a $15, a strong and immediate $15 an hour minimum wage here will massively raise your standard of living. Yet your union leadership is not supporting this. And we want to help you organize to make your union support $15 now. And take that into all the grocery stores and have a conversation with the clerks there and help them organize to do that as a first step to organizing to change their union in general.
Mm-hmm.
So this gets back to, as I said, I supported Sawanta. I even donated money to her campaign. But I feel like they were, as events unfolded, that they did not want to have an open conflict with the union leadership.
Mm-hmm. Or the city council.
Instead of wanting to have it, it's a matter of if you're really going to fight for workers in this country, you have to have that because the union leadership really, as that guy Daniel DeLeon once said, they're the labor lieutenants of capital.
Jim Imons leaning forward.
Yes, he's got, Jim wants to definitely comment on that.
Oh, we brought up DeLeon. Okay, I find it very interesting that the further the unions try to support the Democratic Party, the further to the right the Democratic Party gets.
Right.
I mean, if you go back to Eisenhower or Nixon, you know, there's no comparison. The Republican Party was to the left of what the Democratic Party is now.
Absolutely.
And it's this race to the right to the point where almost, if you quote Benito Mussolini, and I have his text on the only one he ever wrote, The Theory and Social Practice of Fascism, fascism comes into existence when you cannot put, when you cannot put a tissue paper between corporate interests and state interests, end quote. So,
in other words, a corporate state. Corporations controlling the state.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So this was Mussolini's definition of fascism. It wasn't repressing the people. In fact, he wasn't even an anti-Semite. It's real interesting how that alliance with Hitler. Hitler didn't like him.
But anyway, that's an interesting point, yes.
Yeah. And so we cannot revive the labor movement until we break it from the Democratic Party. And the same is true for the black community. It's a real conundrum, but it's something that we have to work at. Now, you know, I'm a revolutionary social democrat like you, John, and we have to support any oppressed and exploited people. It is written on our foreheads, but the solution they come up with isn't always the right one. So you have to be able to work with people. It's the same problem that I have with the International Socialist Organization. They do not have the proletarian orientation. I know a lot of the young people in there. They're devoted. They know a lot. And they work real hard. But it's campus-based. When I joined the Socialist Workers' Party was the proletarian orientation. I went to work in a factory. You know, of course, they were available then.
And this was up in Milwaukee.
This is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
While we had, Frank Zeiler was the Socialist Party mayor up until 62.
Okay.
And at that point, you know, if you want, I try to teach the youth this. If you want to be able to talk to the workers, you have to talk to them on the job. You have to have the same life experience and be one of them. Chairman Mao said, we are like fish in a sea.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and that's a good point, John, because, you know, I think that is part of the problem, too, with our current union's leadership is that they've got their lifestyle is more in common with the bosses, with the capitalist class, than it is with the average worker they represent. Would you agree with that, John? Or?
Yeah, I used to work with this carpenter who said, you can never trust a leader who doesn't live like you.
Mm-hmm.
If he doesn't live like you, you can't trust him.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there's a lot of points that Jim raised that, you know, there's not really time to get into.
Right.
I would like to make, you know, now they've, what's that thing about laboring and bringing forth a mouse? And so now they've got this $15 an hour minimum wage proposal that they passed. And I'd like to make a couple comments on that if I could.
Sure.
So in the first place, I mean, what I said about the Democrats is just absolutely classic about how their role is at times when pressure mounts up to grant a few concessions and in order to head off a wider movement.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what this is. Now, whether or not a wider movement would have been possible, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that they should have tried to build one.
Mm-hmm.
What this and also at the same time, usually within those concessions, there's some ticking time bombs. And there's 2 points, first of all, in what they've passed. As you know, there's this $15 minimum wage ordinance that they've passed, which doesn't 100% take effect until 2025. And because there's all kinds of loopholes in it, loopholes which Sawant in the past said that it has more holes in it than Swiss cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's loopholes for which won't be totally closed until 2025 for workers who get tips, for workers who get health benefits, and so on. For workers who work for companies that have under 500 employees, and so on. And we have to recognize, we have to be aware that one of the main attacks nationally on the whole concept of the minimum wage has been not to eliminate the minimum wage altogether, but to grant all kinds of exceptions,
mm-hmm.
a youth wage, a training wage, a this wage, a that, and so on. Whereas, in general, the minimum wage, not exclusively, but in general, the minimum wage is applied to everybody. So, by passing this minimum wage with all these loopholes, it strengthens that strategy of attacking the minimum wage. Now, the other thing is that they index the minimum wage to the CPI, the cost of living
mm-hmm.
index. And ever since 1990, under Labor's great friend Bill Clinton, they started changing how the CPI was figured in such a way as to greatly underestimate inflation. And so, and they explicitly said that they're chaining it to the CPI up there in Seattle in order to avoid this kind of struggle again. So what's going to happen is that the minimum wage will gradually slip further and further behind the actual cost of living. And people won't really notice it because we'll be told, oh, but it's chained to the CPI. So these are two ticking time bombs contained within this. Now, the other thing, and as I said, the whole campaign started off 15 now, meaning a $15 an hour minimum wage for everybody. And incidentally, the opinion poll showed that the more people heard about the different arguments, the more they supported 15 now.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't get 15 now. They got 15 for some in the near future and for the majority in the more distant future. But now this is being heralded as a historic victory. But, I mean, at best, it's a small step forward.
Mm-hmm.
A historic victory was when the workers in San Francisco went out on a general strike and forced the shipping companies to recognize the longshoremen's union, or when you had the sit-down strikes in auto and they forced GM to recognize the UAW. Those were historic victories.
Yes.
This is, I mean, how can you call this a historic victory?
Yes.
Bill? Okay, I want to, it sounds like to me what we've been talking about is recreating the old Democratic coalition without the Democratic Party. Okay, now as someone who is currently working on construction jobs and working with the people who are the union members who would need to be convinced to be part of that coalition. For example, my union, the laborers, is all balls out for pipelines, man. Pipelines are great for us. And other things, guns. What about gun topics and working with other groups? That you ask somebody on a construction job what the worst problem in our country is right now, you're more than, I think 90% of the time you will hear it's something like people on disability or people on welfare. And
I don't know how the rank and file at this point would not, I don't believe they would sit still for their unions, at least in the building trades that I'm familiar with, to get involved in these things.
You know, in 1999, we had a big wildcat strike of carpenters. 2,000 carpenters here went out on strike against our own union leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And right at the height of that, there was a meeting, Labor for Mumia Abu Jamal in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought about a dozen of the most active strikers who, bear in mind, they've been working almost 24-7 on our own strike. They came to that meeting of Labor for Mumia Abu Jamal. And to me, what that shows is when workers get involved in a struggle, it really transforms their consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And, of course, our own union leadership, especially in the building trades, they do everything they can to prevent their members from getting involved in any kind of struggle. So, sure, then their consciousness goes backwards.
The building trades also have a real elitist attitude in general. As a matter of fact, I remember a laborer I was working with talking about, he was complaining that his local sent people, you might remember when this happened, to South Carolina to organize chicken pluckers. As far as he was concerned, they didn't deserve union organization.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, they do in some ways, but then, as I said, things change. During that wildcat strike, we put out all our leaflets in Spanish and English, and all the English-speaking carpenters thought that was a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'll bet you a lot of them had voted for that English-only initiative just like 6 months or a year earlier.
John?
So it just shows when you get involved in a struggle, all that elitism and all the other stuff tends to fall away.
And you're absolutely right about the consciousness. Going through the experience of a struggle is a consciousness-raising episode in anyone's life. And it changes you forever, especially if you're victorious, even if you're not, but especially. It is that working with your fellow workers and realizing you're part of the same class. Gramsci called it the class in itself, for itself. When that comes into existence, the capitalist class should be on guard. Now, the other point that I'd like to make is that back in the 1930s,
I'm sorry, we can't take a call. Go ahead, John.
Okay. Back in the 1930s.
Call the 9338 line. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Back in the 30s, workers that had bought drank the capitalist Kool-Aid would call labor organizers labor fakers. Well, today there are labor fakers, and that's the AFL-CIO leadership. And we should just call them that.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, and by the way, I am blaming the leadership because they do not educate their members, or they educate them in a wrong way. They educate them to be for pipelines, and they have the gun magazines, you know, totally rabid right-wing gun publications sitting right there on the counter when you pay your dues.
And that's why, again, you get back to that 15 Now campaign. I think that more could have been and should have been done to take it directly to workers, whether it be construction workers
mm-hmm.
or workers
yes.
in the supermarket or workers at McDonald's.
Amen.
And, you know, we know that we've been in a period when it's hard to get workers involved in a struggle, but that period is coming to an end. And so I feel like, especially when you had somebody with a high profile up there, I'm talking about Sawant, when you had somebody like that, maybe it would have been possible to break through that mood and really start to create a movement. And if that had been done, you know, all the things we're talking about the, you know, all the confusions and backwardness and stuff of some workers, that would have started to change in a really significant way. And if that had happened, to me, that would have been more important than the byproduct of it, which would have been an even stronger $15 an hour ordinance.
Yeah, John, you know, the other thing, too, is if somebody is, you know, gets elected to, say, the city council and in whatever city, and they're, you know, basically saying that they're there as a representative of working people, then from day one, their concern shouldn't be to get along with the other council members.
Right.
It should be to use their position as what Jim Iman calls a bully pulpit, and to use the council meetings to basically talk about the issues and pack the audience of the city council chambers with working people, supporters, and use that as a way to take the next to the next step. Because these people, the capitalist class and their paid off cronies, they're not going to give up anything without a fight. I mean, let's face it.
Right.
I mean, you know, we've seen history's proven this. Nothing significant for the better has ever changed the course of U.S. history without some kind of struggle.
Yeah. Their position should be, look, these people are Democrats and Republicans for a reason. They represent big business, corporate America. I'm a socialist for a reason. I represent the working class.
Mm-hmm.
We have a conflict, and we are going to struggle over that conflict out in the open. There's going to be no secret deals, no executive sessions where I don't reveal to my class what's going on, none of that. And let's remember something else. All the great leaders, from Eugene Debs to Martin Luther King to you name it, have served time in prison because they fought for the workers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So my feeling is if Shama Sawant had to go in and have a workplace rally at one of the supermarkets or in a McDonald's there, and she got arrested for trespassing and going to and went to prison for it, then so be it. That would actually help boost the movement, and it would really help her too, I believe.
Yes, indeed. Any last comments, Bill and Jim?
And if I can,
yes, go ahead, John.
But before we finish, I'd like to once again give people my website
yes,
and so on.
Please do.
So anybody that's interested in this point of view, I urge them to look at the website oaklandsocialist.com. And also they can contact me at 1999, that's the numbers, 1999wildcat@gmail.com.
Okay, great, John. And Jim, Bill, any last comments?
I would like to think of a future show where we discuss the role of organized labor in declining environments and economies in a world where growth will only destroy us.
Okay.
Definitely.
And Jim?
Well, Bill's actually right here. The more you see an economy grow, the growth rate is also a pollution rate. The more growth, the more pollution. Let's cut the growth.
Okay.
And let everybody live. First of all, $15 an hour isn't even a living
wage. More growth
wage.
Is more exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
Yeah. Literally.
Yeah. And $15 is not a living wage to begin with. If you figure in a COL from 1960 and you add also production efficiency, it's about $22.50.
Well, it should be, yes. Okay, well, we're run out of time. John Ryman, thank you so much for calling in. This has been a very, interesting and enlightening show. And,
Public relations.
Oh, yes, which I think kind of ties in with this. Thanks for calling in, John.
Propaganda.
Okay. All right. You've been listening to the World Labor Hour on WFT List Support Community Radio Station. And stay tuned after we close here with Patti Smith, People Have the Power, for the Union Edge with host Charles Showalter out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In the meantime, during the next week, be safe and power to the people. Take care.